from the Dangers studio on Library Square. This is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, part two of our conversation with Rose Gottmuller, Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security at the U.S. State Department. Today, we'll take a look at why the United States hasn't signed the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, at some of the threats that are out there when it comes to securing and maintaining nuclear materials, as well as at how Gottmuller herself became involved in this work. That conversation, political cornflakes with Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent Thomas Burr, and a summary of your day's top local news stories coming up on The Rundown here on KCPW. First up, though, we have these messages. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up on the show, part two of a conversation about nuclear arms control and international security. But first up, we have these headlines. The commander of the Utah National Guard says its members could face career-ending penalties for allowing a risque video shoot featuring bikini-clad British women firing high-powered weapons and riding in tanks to be partially filmed at a military training camp. Major General Jeff Burton says the handful of military members could see fines, demotions, or forced retirements when the investigation is completed. He says he knows who let the women and crew onto Camp Williams, and that guardsmen didn't follow protocol when they allowed military equipment to be used in the shoot. A separate investigation shows that a state police officer participating in the shoot was on duty at the time. Another officer appears in uniform in the video, but wasn't on the clock. Department of Public Safety spokesman Doug McCleave also says three state-owned guns were used in the unsanctioned video shoot. As discussed on Behind the Headlines this morning here on KCPW, a new church essay says Mormon church founder Joseph Smith had a teenage bride and was married to other men's wives during the early days of the faith when polygamy was practiced. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints says that most of Smith's wives were adults, but one was a 14-year-old girl who was the daughter of Smith's close friends. Research shows that the marriage might not have involved sex. It's the first time the church has officially acknowledged those facts, although it has not denied previous reports by historians. Church officials note that while inappropriate by today's standards, the marrying of teenage girls was legal and somewhat common during the time period. The essay, posted this week, is part of a recent push by the Salt Lake City-based religion to explain or expand on sensitive issues within the faith, including, among other things, its past ban on black men in the church's lay clergy. Finally today, the Utah Supreme Court has lifted its hold on adoptions by same-sex couples. The state's high court originally suspended all such adoptions in May, as Utah appealed a federal ruling striking down the state's ban on same-sex marriage. But earlier this month, the U.S. Supreme Court allowed that decision to stand, effectively legalizing same-sex unions in Utah and 10 other states. The Salt Lake Tribune reports that Thursday's decision to lift the hold came in the cases of four adoptions sought by wedded same-sex couples. The state Supreme Court's decision will presumably allow those adoptions and others to proceed, something that legal analysts say is the consequence of the federal high court's ruling earlier this month. Equality Utah Director Troy Williams told the newspaper that same-sex families across the state are celebrating. And that does it for our summary of the day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. This is The Rundown. We'll be right back. The House Oversight Committee was holding a hearing this morning about Ebola. Utah Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz was there. So what was he saying? I posed that question to Thomas Burr, Washington correspondent with the Salt Lake Tribune and author of Political Cornflakes, a daily online roundup of Utah politics.
So clearly Republicans see an issue here with the Obama administration, and of course it's an election year, so they're milking it. But you know, it is also a serious public health issue and one that doesn't seem to be going well for the administration. So, you know, there's something there. Chaffetz is concerned. Chaffetz is here in Washington. He's concerned about Obama's new Ebola czar, Ron Klain, who isn't a medical doctor and refused to testify before the committee today about what the administration is doing. Klain just started his job on Wednesday, so perhaps he was just a wee bit busy with other things at the moment. But, you know, now we're hearing, you know, someone's in New York City, has Ebola, and has been riding the subway. There are definitely some concerns and some reasons to investigate what the nation is doing to protect Americans from this fatal virus.
You know, it's kind of interesting that the Ebola czar wouldn't be a medical doctor. I suppose maybe that's not necessary if you have other other skills. Do we know much about this guy's background?
Yeah, in fact, if you've ever seen the movie about the 2000 election, he was Al Gore's chief of staff when he was vice president. He was really involved in, you know, the administration, Clinton, Gore, and Obama too. You know, he isn't a medical doctor, but it's the same way that, you know, Obama's not a medical doctor either. You don't have one person who can be everything. So maybe the person who's responsible for management doesn't have to be the doctor, because right. The country does have a few doctors around.
Right. That makes sense. The other thing about this is that I read just this morning, in fact, that, you know, more Americans are going to die of the common flu than they are likely to die of Ebola by a long shot. Is there, you know, a lot of fervor over this that is both political and media fueled, but maybe not as big a deal here as it's being made out to be?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, if you're in the United States, you have a better chance of dying in a car crash on your way to get tested to see if you have Ebola for some reason. So, you know, you can die in a plane crash or get struck by lightning, more chances of doing that than getting Ebola. But, you know, there's a concern when you have a deadly virus and you see things popping up that shouldn't be, like, you know, someone riding the subway, someone, you know, going to get fast food who has been to a West African country.
Wedding, we
want to make sure our government is responding.
Sorry to be talking over you, Thomas. There was the case of the nurse who had Ebola who was allowed to travel to that wedding. But what you're saying makes sense, and I guess we'll have to just see, you know, the results of this oversight committee hearing and whether or not any changes are made for the future. In entirely different news, Thomas, Utah's Republican members of Congress came out to support Mia Love this week and also to slam Doug Owens for what they say are negative personal attacks. Why did Utah's Republican congressmen feel the need to do this?
You know, it's pretty obvious. I don't think they needed to come out and say they support Mia Love, because it's clear the Utah Republicans members are supporting, backing Mia Love. But they probably sensed an opportunity to get some press coverage attacking Owens. Owens has said he's running ads, you know, contrasting himself with Love, and he's not being negative. But Senators Orrin Hatch and Mike Lee and, you know, the rest of the gang think that he's going too far. We've already seen Utah Democratic Party Chairman Peter Caroon use Burger King Whoppers to criticize Love for what he said were big Whoppers, she told during the debate between her and Owens. So I guess this is as exciting as the 4th District race is going to be.
You know, I also just read that Peter Caroon delivered a bunch of rubber chickens to Republican headquarters here in Salt Lake City because Mia Love didn't show up for a Rotary Club debate. Lots of weird stuff going on in this election cycle.
Got to do something to get some press coverage, you know, that otherwise people are just going to fly under the radar.
Here's another question for you, Thomas. I don't know if you've had a chance to see these ads. I have, you know, I've only caught the mere glimpses of them, but are they actually negative, you know, really personal attacks?
You know, I don't think Utahns have seen the level of negative attacks that actually are in other states. Utah is a state where people don't like to use negative ads because it can backfire. So they really do pale in comparison to some of the ads that are out there in other states right now. For example, I would really not want to be a South Dakota resident right now, that three-way Senate race they have going on and all the deluge of ads that are going on TV. In fact, we should probably ship them some tapes of regular ads. They haven't seen toothpaste ads for a while.
They only know mudslinging. I guess that's all they have. All right, well, let's do that. Thomas, finally today, in other interesting political news, it appears that Donald Trump isn't a fan of Mitt Romney running for office again. What did Donald Trump have to say this week about that?
You know, you got to love the Don. So he was asked this week about, you know, the Romney idea of running for a third time, or the idea of Romney running a third time. And he said he shouldn't have run. Quote, he had his chance and he blew it. He noted that, you know, that he had a pretty good chance in 2012 and should have won, but he didn't. And that actually 2016, if the Democrats put Hillary Clinton up, will be a much more difficult race to run in. Just directly quoting Donald Trump, whether it was him or his consultants, he blew it. He had a tremendous advantage against a president who has done very poorly and now has done worse. So, you know, I guess that the Don is not going to be sending any money or appearing with Mitt Romney again.
Two questions on this, Thomas. One, was Donald Trump at any point a contributor to Mitt Romney's campaign? And then two, is the Donald, whatever his name is, you know, he's in the past had his own presidential aspirations. Is that something he's thinking about doing?
I saw him speak not too long ago at the National Press Club, and he was very much clear that he wasn't trying to run for president. Everyone was trying to get him to run for president. You can read into that what you want to. But, you know, he's going to keep his name out there because he's really good at that. But I don't know if he ever gave money to Romney, but there was that one time when Mitt Romney flew into Vegas and, you know, the Donald gave his big endorsement and big bear hug of Romney for the nomination.
Right.
So there was, he did back the 2012 campaign. It doesn't seem like he's going to back a 2016 campaign for Mitt.
And no preferred candidate from Donald Trump's perspective yet.
Not yet, but you know, he wants everyone to court him.
Well, really bizarre stuff. The world of fundraising and what you have to do to get these high level endorsements. Thomas Burr, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thanks, Roger.
Thomas Burr is Washington correspondent for the Salt Lake Tribune and author of Political Cornflakes, a daily online roundup of Utah politics. He joins us weekly for this conversation, and you can find a link to Political Cornflakes at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. You're tuned into The Rundown. Stay with us. Thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. I'm Roger McDonough. Now on the show, part two of our conversation with Rose Gottmuller, Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security at the U.S. State Department. Gottmuller spoke at Westminster College recently as part of the Ambassador John Price and Marcia Price World Affairs Lecture Series presented by the Utah Council for Citizen Diplomacy in partnership with Westminster College and HEAL Utah. Yesterday on the program, we talked about the state of nuclear arms reduction efforts around the globe, some of the threats to our aging nuclear infrastructure, and what a strained relationship between Russia and the United States means for these efforts, and in particular, complying with various international treaties. Today on the show, we'll take a look at the biggest threats when it comes to securing nuclear materials, why the U.S. hasn't ratified the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, and more. This is a little bit of a turn of questions, but I'm wondering, the United States didn't end up ratifying the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the CTBT. I guess, why didn't that happen? And one of the reasons I'm asking the question is because the Utah State Legislature, not too many years ago, urged Congress to ratify it. I'm wondering, what more can, say, citizens do to see that happen? You know, Utah has a downwinder history from the Nevada test site here, and I think it's something that a lot of people would like to see happen. But we haven't done that. Why did that not happen?
In 1999, when the treaty came before the Senate for its advice and consent, the senators had two main concerns. First of all, they said, well, you say you're going to do a science-based stockpile stewardship program and that we won't need nuclear testing. But how do we know that science-based stockpile stewardship actually works? This program is only 3 years old. We don't know if it's going to work or not. How can we possibly agree to ban nuclear testing forever? So that was the first issue. The second issue was they said, well, look, you say you're going to build a big international monitoring system that will have very good verification and monitoring of the treaty, but the system isn't built yet. How do we know it's actually going to happen? So that was 15 years ago. 15 years later, we have a very capable science-based stockpile stewardship now. In fact, Secretary of Energy Ernie Moniz was speaking about this in early September. He said our national laboratories, who were not at all sure that science-based stockpile stewardship would work back in 1999, are now saying that they actually know more about nuclear weapons through science-based stockpile stewardship than they knew during the era of nuclear explosive testing. So I think there's a good answer now to the question about whether the stockpile stewardship program works. By the way, if your listeners don't know what it is, it essentially uses analytical techniques, including supercomputing and some materials techniques and so forth to determine the status of the weapons in our stockpile without having to test them explosively. So that's that issue. The second issue on monitoring and verification, again, now the international monitoring system, which is managed by the CTBTO, is over 90% complete, and it's already doing a great job doing things like tracking seismic data after tsunami events and providing that information into the International and Pacific Tsunami Warning Center. So great work already being done by the IMS. It really works. So
right.
We have some good answers to those questions that the senators raised back in 99.
And so does that mean that there is a future of us ratifying a comprehensive test ban treaty? Or is that done? Maybe I'm way behind the times here.
No. We've still got a lot of work to do because this, 1999 was 15 years ago. The treaty has not been through before the American public in all that time, and they've kind of forgotten about it. Although in 1999, 85% of the American public supported the CTBT, but we don't know what people think about it nowadays. And equally important, the Senate has changed quite a bit in these 15 years, and so we need to take some good time to talk to the American public about the value of this treaty, to talk to the senators and their staffs about the value of this treaty, and to give people a chance to ask questions about it. How does it work? Is it in U.S. national security interests? How can we be sure it can be verified? All of those questions we need to answer.
A lot of policy work to be done. Yeah, another question that's just occurring to me now is how many new nuclear weapons are constructed on a yearly basis around the world? Do you have a sense of that?
You're catching me off guard here. I would leave your listeners with the impression that it's not a huge amount. People, I talk about the numbers that were built during the Cold War when we were really ramping up and built up to the level of over 31,000. There's nowhere near that kind of production going on anymore around the world. And I will say that we and the Russians have over 90% of the nuclear weapons in the world, and we're getting our numbers down much lower. When you're talking about other nuclear weapon states, China, when you're talking about UK and France, their numbers are way down, below 500. So it's not the same kind of situation that you're talking about when you're talking about U.S. and Russia, who still have several thousand each. But nevertheless, not a big buildup going on right now, and that's a good thing. And also, among the other nuclear weapon states, there's on an annual basis, I would say, not a lot going on.
Okay. I'm taking up a lot of your time, and I have just a few more questions, one of which is, when we look at the recent past, do the policy aims on this issue, on nuclear arms and arms control, disarmament, et cetera, do they change very widely from one administration to the next, or is it pretty consistent?
The history of nuclear arms control and disarmament has been somewhat cyclical in its nature, but I would say that presidents from the period in the late 1960s after the Cuban Missile Crisis, governments have embraced, presidents have embraced the notion that we need to move to reduce and eliminate nuclear weapons. And a particularly strong actor in that regard was Ronald Reagan, who I think came in not at all convinced necessarily about the need to reduce and eliminate nuclear weapons, but at the Reykjavik summit came to articulate one of the most strong statements about that, in saying that we should move towards zero nuclear weapons. So presidents on both sides of the aisle have embraced this goal, and President Bush, in his time in office, negotiated and brought into force the so-called Moscow Treaty, which reduced deployed warhead numbers. So I would say each of the presidents throughout the last 40 years has had some particular goals in mind.
A piece of it. I have just two more questions. One is, we mentioned the possibility, or the very scary possibility of terrorists getting control of nuclear material. There are a number of threats, I'm sure, but what are the biggest threats currently when it comes to nuclear weapons and materials? Is that, it may be remote, it may not be, but what are sort of the largest concerns right now in the community that you operate in?
First of all, I want to stress that I think the chance of terrorists getting their hands on a nuclear warhead or fissile material and then actually effectively using it to produce a nuclear detonation, the chance of that is pretty small. But it is such a dire threat, and one that is undeterrable by normal, deterrence approaches, deterrence policy, that we have to grapple with it very, very seriously and put a lot of resources into really minimizing the use of fission materials around the world in things like research reactors and so forth, and also steadily reducing and eliminating nuclear weapons. So small chance, but enormous threat. So we really, really need to treat it seriously.
And then in terms of, I don't know, state actors or other nuclear threats, are those out there? And what are, I mean, I'm sure that there are plenty, but what are the main concerns on the global stage? And how are they being addressed?
I think something to really consider that is different from what happened during the Cold War, when it was really the United States and Soviet Union who were faced off against each other as the main nuclear powers. Now we have some other actors in the game who are, you know, in a very serious and potential crisis face-off. I'm thinking particularly of the situation in South Asia between India and Pakistan, where we've had a number of crises emerge over the years, and now both of these states are states that deploy nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. So there, I think we can do everything to try to encourage those two countries to come back to the negotiating table, to work on confidence-building measures. They have in the past had some pretty solid ideas about nuclear confidence and predictability measures. So we are trying to encourage both of them to get back to the table on those things. So there are different ways to work these problems. Sometimes it is, you know, you have to take action to protect nuclear materials in the case of terrorists. In other areas, like the situation in South Asia, you work diplomatically to try to encourage policy progress.
Finally today, you've been deeply involved in this work for many years, and I'm wondering if you, in your own mind, have, well, actually, two-part question. How did you first get into this? How did this become your issue? And then secondarily, do you have a kind of ultimate goal in mind, or maybe better put, do you want to see a world entirely without nuclear weapons, vision you want to see carried out?
It's kind of funny, probably, for your listeners, but I call myself a Sputnik baby because I was a small child when the Soviets launched that Sputnik satellite. And I remember my dad taking me out into the yard in Columbus, Ohio, when I was just a small child and just growing up. And he said, "Oh, look at that small pinpoint of light up there. It's going over. That's a Soviet satellite. Mm-hmm. That's Sputnik." And I didn't know what that was. But of course, that aroused a huge, huge scandal in the United States with our government and everybody saying, "Oh, they're getting ahead of us in science. We really have to work hard to catch up with the Soviets." Right. And at that point, they put in place Russian language programs in many high schools throughout the United States, no doubt here in Utah as well. And in Ohio, I started studying Russian in high school and got very, very interested in Russian language. Mm-hmm. Went on to Georgetown University and studied there. And at about that time, the first détente, so-called first détente in the 1970s, came on the scene, and the first Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty was negotiated. So that's how really I got interested. It was through being a Sputnik baby and studying the Russian language that I came into it.
And then in terms of sort of personal goals, I mean, do you want to see a world without nuclear weapons? It seems like a very soft question, but I'm curious if you can answer that even as somebody who's involved in this work.
You know, not only as working for this president, President Obama, who put out that goal as a serious pursuit of policy in the Prague agenda initiative that he launched in 2009, but also in the world of the Non-Proliferation Treaty regime, where Article 6 of the NPT really calls upon all the nuclear weapons states to disarm, to reduce and eliminate nuclear weapons down to zero. So those two, I consider them almost foundational documents, in the one case a treaty, in the other the president's initiative, I feel are important commitments and obligations of the United States. And I feel that really personally. I am also a pragmatist at heart, and I believe that we have to take it in a step-by-step way. The president himself said this is something that won't happen overnight. He said, "Not in my lifetime." So I hope if not in my lifetime, then maybe in my kids' lifetime.
Rose Gottemuller is Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security at the U.S. State Department. I really want to thank you for coming in and having this conversation with us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
I'm Roger McDonough. You're tuned into The Rundown. We'll be right back. Thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Our show today was produced by yours truly, with additional help from Ross Chambliss, Ryan Cunningham, and news intern Mycel Spotted Elk. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tune in each weekday at 5 for an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you on The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned next for the Utah Business Report and Marketplace.